section there in order to complete that first exercise anyway. So section 373 is the meaning of the perfect and pluperfect. The Greek perfect may usually be adequately rendered by the English perfect, have plus participle. That's the way we do it in English. So I have seen, I have come, etc. The Greek perfect differs from the Greek aorist in that it emphasizes the continuing result of the action which was completed in past time. Thus, he is risen usually represents a perfect passive of egero, literally he has been raised, Mark 6:14, etc., which points to the result of the resurrection. In other words, in the New Testament, when it says that he has been raised or he has risen, there's usually a perfect form there, because the point is that it happened in the past, and we are continually abiding in the result of that. In other words, the emphasis on the result of the fact. And so perfect forms are used in this. And it says, so which points to the result of the resurrection. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9:1, Yesun he oraka, Jesus have I have seen Jesus. And he oraka is a perfect active of horao. And so to say I have seen Jesus, especially in the context in which he's saying it and so forth, as a qualification for being an apostle, is the fact that he is an apostle as a continuing result. In other words, he has seen Jesus, he has had that experience, and he continually lives with that experience. He's living his life with a result of that experience, as it were. And so he is qualified to be an apostle. That was one of the criteria that some were looking at anyway. The English perfect does not emphasize a result, but simply indicates that the speaker or writer does not intend to interpose a distinct interval between the events of which he uses the perfect tense and the time of speaking or writing. So that's more along the ideas of a completed action, you know, that the action was completed and when you use a perfect, you're not trying to interpose a distinct time interval between those. It might have happened a few minutes ago, it might have happened, you know, 100 years ago or whatever. You're not really emphasizing that. That's what he's claiming about English. And now, I don't know, an English scholar, you know, might have to look at this and analyze the senses in which the English perfect is used. But for our purposes, we're concerned more with the Greek than the English right now anyway. And the difference is that, well, he says the English perfect accordingly sometimes represents a Greek aorist, sometimes a Greek perfect. In other words, if we say something and we use a perfect tense in it, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to use a perfect tense if you put that in Greek. Very often you'd just use an aorist, because all you're trying to express is that the action was completed sometime in the past, and you're not really interested in too much more than that. If that's the case, you'd probably use an aorist in Greek. But if you're wanting to really emphasize the fact that you're living with the present result of it, then you'd use the perfect in Greek. So Greek's got a little bit more refinement in this area between the use of the aorist and the perfect. And that's something we'll just have to watch as we start to do our translating. We'll start with the Gospel of John here just as soon as we finish this text. And we're going to do several things at the same time here. Once we finish the text, we're going to be doing translating, working from Dane and Manti, doing diagramming, all of those things concurrently. In other words, one day we'll do this and the other day we'll do that and so forth. So we kind of get a balance between them. So I really want to get us into the text and really working with it as soon as possible. And as we do that, we'll be watching for these distinctions between perfect and aorist and imperfect forms, especially in our past tense ideas. Now, the Greek pluperfect represents an action as complete at a point in past time and as having then an existing result. So, in effect, what the pluperfect is projecting the whole idea of the perfect, that whole set, back into the past. Now, sometimes it's diagrammed this way, some of the textbooks, so the perfect is diagrammed as a dot here with a line like this. In other words, an aorist would just be the dot back here. That's where they get the term punctiliar. So what is it? Just the action took place in an instant of time only, but that's the way you're conceiving of the action. You're just referring to the action happening. You're not really worried about whether it's continuing or not. Your imperfect would be more, you know, like a progressive, like a line, a progressive aspect. The action was taking place in the past. This was happening. This is just the aorist idea. And then the perfect idea is an action taking place in the past, much like an aorist idea, but the result is continuing. Now, a pluperfect, so I'll mark this as the present here. Maybe this will be our present line. Your pluperfect would be something like this, and your line of reference is back here. In other words, what you're saying is that back at this point in time, the action took place prior to that time and had a continuing result at that point in time and past. In other words, he had done this. For example, he had completed the work or something back here. So when you say he had completed the work, then at some time in the past that you're referring to, he had previous to that completed the work. So you've got a two-stage past tense here almost is the way I think of it. You're projecting yourself into the past, as it were, and then observing an event prior to that. So this is the idea of the pluperfect. Yes?
Is it indefinite as to whether or not the action continues into the present?
As far as the pluperfect is concerned? Yes, it's not really definitive, so much definitive. Usually, I think it's used more often when the action was completely finished. But neither the perfect nor the pluperfect necessarily demand that the action isn't continuing to go on. But it's just not focusing on that. Usually you get into an imperfect or something if you wanted to indicate something like that. So it doesn't preclude that, but that it's usually not relevant to what you're saying. What you're saying is concerning the event that took place at that time. The result, though, is continuing. And the result in a pluperfect may even continue past that point that you're talking about here. In other words, that result may continue present, although it may not. But all you're concerned about as far as using a pluperfect is this point in time in the past, and then the action relative to that point in time in the past was, in other words, the action was a perfect action at this point in time. And it may continue to the present time, but you're not really focusing on that. Okay. Any questions there yet? No, he's not actually back there, but the person speaking is referring to an event back in past time. And so he's kind of carrying you by his words into looking at that situation.
Yeah.
Right. For example, if I say the Lord had saved the disciples, and it's referring back to a narrative or something that the Lord had saved the disciples, for example, then what's happening there is that you're here at this point in time, you're telling somebody a story about something that happened in the past. And so you're bringing them back to this point here, in effect, and at that point the Lord had saved the disciples, you know. And so it's kind of carrying them back to this point and then to observe the action as past relative to this point, which is also in the past. So like I say, you've got two-stage past tense, as it were. You're talking about an event that took place in the past, and then with reference to that event, there was another event that took place even further in the past. Okay? But it's not really... it's easy to tell that that's what's happening. In other words, I'm not saying that that the whole thing is being shifted into the past, and then you're continuing forever in the past on that. Pluperfect is just kind of... you're going along up here, and then you're referring to something way back there, and then something before that time. And those things will happen, and the Old Testament gets a little bit tougher with these things, because in the Old Testament you don't have this refinement of tenses. And to get a pluperfect idea, you have to use usually a perfect verb form, and there get to be some complications. Perfect plus context is what you have to do, and there isn't that much refinement. But with Greek, it's a very interesting verb form. And of course, in English we can do it too, by using a past tense form of the verb to be, and then a participle. So he had done this. So to show the example here, he said the Greek pluperfect represents an action as complete at a point in past time and as having then an existing result. The Greek pluperfect will always be represented by an English pluperfect. I had seen, I had come, etc. But the English pluperfect will sometimes correspond to other Greek tenses, for example, the aorist and so forth. In other words, again, the Greek and English aren't necessarily going to line up on this. If you see a pluperfect in Greek, you can always translate that by a pluperfect in English. But a pluperfect in English may not always come out as a pluperfect in Greek. It may come out just as an aorist. Here's an example, because what they may do is use an aorist plus context to get that idea. For example, here, hota un elaben to oxos ho Jesus apen tetelestai. And when, therefore, Jesus had received the vinegar, he said, it is finished. Actually, in English, we're translating that, had received, when Jesus had received the vinegar. That's a pluperfect in English. But the Greek, you can see, is just elaben, and that's just an aorist. So, you see, in English, you might even translate, when Jesus received the vinegar, he said, it is finished, and we can just use a past tense for that, too. But if you want to try to specify that he said it is finished after he'd said, after he'd received the vinegar, then you'd use a pluperfect. In other words, the point of that would be that he had received it, and then he said it's finished. So you've got two sequential things, both in the past tense, one of them following the other. And to try to specify that, we might use a pluperfect in English. But in the Greek here, it's just an aorist is used. And you can just take aorist plus context to get that idea. But if you see a pluperfect in Greek, there's usually a very good reason for it. It's not nebulous at all. And if it's a pluperfect in Greek, it's there for a reason. And be sure and translate it with a pluperfect in English. I'm sorry.
They didn't use that as part of the
exam. Yes, yeah. That's perfect also, but that's just this statement, his quotation. Yeah, it's a perfect form. Yeah, and of course there, it is finished. It is finished is, again, talking about, and see, this is kind of prophetic because, well, in a sense it wasn't. As far as he was concerned, it had happened. He hadn't fully expired yet, but as far as he was concerned, it was finished. And so it was a past tense with a continuing result. And remember, too, that the perfect is oftentimes used in situations like this where it's almost an immediate thing. The statement comes immediately after the action. In other words, don't think of the action as way, way back in the past, not necessarily. It may be a response right after an action has taken place. It is finished like this, or it's happened, and we've got the result of it. So it doesn't necessarily need to involve a lot of time, but the action is still conceived of, at least, as being prior to the statement here. But this is kind of in almost a prophetic sense, too, so you have to recognize that. Okay, Mark, you had something there I didn't want to... Oh, was it? Okay. Okay, and Greg, did you have anything more on this? Well, go ahead and ask it now because before I get in these forms.
In regards to Colossians 1:16,
mm-hmm.
Where you see the picture of the parents and the servant,
uh-huh.
Still, if I haven't figured out, you know, the meaning of the
perfect
and how that relates to that,
I'd be
explain that.
Well, yeah, you have to review me a little bit on the. It's in him were all things created and so forth. Which one's perfect and which one's aorist?
In him were all things created.
Mm-hmm.
And all things were created or have been created through him.
Okay. The first statement would just be indicating, not putting too much emphasis upon, it's just more of a historical fact. In him were all things created. And maybe more of a broad and general thing. And then when he starts going into specifics, whether things in heaven, things in earth, and so forth, all things have been created through him and for him. There it's just emphasizing the fact that we have the continuing result of this. And perhaps especially because the spiritual meaning of this thing is getting into the saints, it's getting into the fact that it's through him that we are created. And we are being made right now, and things are happening in our lives that are going to result in a continuing, an eternal result. That would be the sense that's being seen there. Now, remember, it's a matter of emphasis. It's not so much a real, clear, blatant, powerful, black and white thing. There's an emphasis. You see the aorist, and you're picking up a certain sense. And it's more indefinite. It hasn't really gelled so much. And then when you see the perfect used later, and after you've seen more specifics, now you get a perfect form. There's just this kind of a feeling that it's something that we're living with. It's something more immediate. In other words, not a distant reference to the initial creation way back there, but it's talking about things that are happening in our lives right now and results that we are living with. It's true, of course, we're obviously living with the result of the initial creation, too. But it gets more of an immediacy. That's my surface impression would be, but it would be deserving of a lot more study. In other words, that's the kind of passage I'd want to look at, just because its implications are, you know, it's not just a simple historical narrative. It's it involves a lot of prophetic and the whole broad scale of things. So that'd be a good one to to have somebody pursue in more detail. But in order to do it, of course, you'd want to look at parallels and see if other passages are doing the same kind of thing, switching from an aorist to a perfect.
It sounds like the results of the creation are continuing.
Yes, right.
That's kind of that perfect.
Sure.
It hasn't quite made sense yet.
Yeah, right. It's just
going through and into him.
Right.
It seems like somebody going through and into him would take an action.
There is an action there. But it's oftentimes being conceived, you know, as a number of stages or steps that are going on. The scripture says we're created in Him, created in Christ Jesus unto good works and so forth. And it sounds like everything's all done, but we know it's not all done. The process is still going on, but that's the process that's taking place. And at each stage in the process, we are living with the result of that stage of it, as it were. And so you have to get some of the other things come from the semantics of the thing, you know, in other words, just what the words mean and how they tie into the rest of Scripture. And then having that understanding, you apply also the understanding of the actual verb forms and get more meaning yet. So that wouldn't be too much of a problem, actually, as far as the Greek grammar is concerned, because it doesn't necessarily mean that the result is final. In other words, that's it. If you see a perfect form, and it means that you're living with the present result of it, it doesn't mean that the action is totally finalized and totally completed, nor does it mean that the result is as far as it's ever going to get. You know, it's this has happened to a point, we've got a result of it, but we can expect it to continue. If the context is demanding that, or if the if other passages do. So that's in other words, what I'm saying is, we want to get, just like with prepositions, get the root idea in our mind of what the perfect is doing. And then having that root basic idea, then we add that understanding to the context, to parallel passages and everything else to come up with a total picture. And all of those things are going to affect it somehow. In other words, they're going to refine or define the sense in which the result continues and, you know, the degree to which and etc. All of those things are going to have to be determined by other factors besides the verb form. The verb form's got the basic idea, but it's still got to be qualified by other things.
Do you think it might reflect like a Hebrew perfect, that it might be used in the same sense where
Yeah, and that comes also from context plus the perfect form. In other words, in Hebrew, you may use a perfect to express what's equivalent to a perfect in Greek, or an aorist in Greek, or an imperfect in Greek. Well, usually for the imperfect, you'd most likely see an imperfect in Hebrew. To indicate even in the past tense a continuing action, but it's again context that's being added to that, and again very often the perfect form in Hebrew, and that's one of the reasons they called it perfect, is because it talks about a past action and the result continues, and that's almost always the case with any past action. I mean, there's very few past actions that don't have certain results. And even an aorist, you know, form, just talking about past action, if you really analyze the situation, you probably could say it had a present result, but that was not being emphasized by the verb form. In other words, it kind of depends not so much on what happened actually and what the facts were, but how the one who's speaking or writing perceives of those facts, or how he's using those facts to build another argument. If he's just talking about it, just the fact that something occurred in the past, and he's not really emphasizing anything else, he'd probably use aorist. But if he wants to emphasize the fact that we're living with the result of it, then they'd use the perfect in the Greek. So that's something we always need to keep in mind. It's how the action is being perceived. That's what determines the difference between an aorist and an imperfect also in the Greek. How is the action being perceived? It's conceivable. You see, some people could argue, well, in this passage in Mark, it uses an imperfect. And in Luke, for the same thing, it uses an aorist. So they'll say, well, aorist and imperfect mean the same thing. That's what some people conclude. And I'm saying, nay, nay, nay. That's not the point at all. True that the very same action may be in one place called spoken of as imperfect and another place spoken of as aorist. But that doesn't have any bearing on the actual action itself. It has a bearing on how the action is being perceived by the author at that time, or by the writer. In one instance, they may be perceiving of the action as error simply because it's just pointing to the fact that the action occurred and there's no emphasis on how it occurred. And the other one is giving you some more detail as to how the action occurred. You put them together and you realize the action was a progressive action, but once it, when it took place, but after it's taken place, we may perceive of the whole thing as an aorist idea because we don't maybe don't care at that point whether it was progressive or not. So that's something to keep in mind, and say with a perfect verb form too, you might find another passage uses a perfect for the same thing, and there it's emphasizing the result of it. And so we, to get a full picture of it, we may want to put all of those together and realize that it was an action that took place over a period of time in the past that has a present result, and that has a bearing on something else, and that's why it was conceived of as aorist. So that's just something to keep in mind. It's not a necessarily black and white thing. In other words, a given action may not be specified only by one of these forms. It may be specified by more than one of them because there's features of it or aspects of it that need to be looked at from several different viewpoints. Okay, any other questions on these meanings? A lot of the refinement is going to come as we actually translate. And when we get into the text and translate, I'll be pointing out these things as we go. We run across a perfect form, I'll ask what's there for and known. And as we keep looking at those and noticing what forms are what, that's when you start getting the feeling for it, as it were, the being able to identify with it a little bit more. It's hard when you just got a grammar book with the forms in front of you. You know, it's it gives some examples, and that helps, but it helps a lot more to really be seeing it in the flow of the entire narrative. Yeah, Quinn?
What kind of forms are those when you might have been and would have been?
Oh, might have been, would have been. Those usually, get, as far as Greek is concerned, they're going to get into those hypotheticals of using subjunctives, and then optative we're going to get to in chapter 50, but that optative is pretty rare. Mostly you're going to see subjunctive situations. Either that or a whole context, especially like with Hebrew, they'll do it with a whole context situation. And subjunctives in what? Not directly. There's no subjunctive forms in the New Testament, but what they'll do is they'll use a subjunctive plus a participle of the perfect. So they'll get the idea, you know, that this might have been or something. They would use, say, a form of the verb to be and put that in the subjunctive and then put the participle there to get the perfect idea. So I think he made a statement to that effect somewhere. Page 290. Part C there, right, a little bit below the middle of the page. So subjunctive, no perfect subjunctive form occurs in the New Testament. Where necessary, it's placed and taken by a perfect participle plus a subjunctive form of ame. So this is what we call a periphrastic construction. In other words, it's another way to express it.
That's the form you see kind of.
Right. If you would run across that, that's probably what you'd see. Right. You know, something might have been, or
not know what he's talking about.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's the way. Yeah. That's just kind of a grammatical description, but it would have been good to give an example of it. And I wish he had put one. I don't know, you know, where you would find one. You probably should have to look up the subjunctive forms of ame and try to search them out. But apparently, that's what we will see. I don't think it's going to occur very frequently. Yes.
Just was wondering back on oida. I'm wondering what's the difference between oida and gnosko.
No, they're different, and I'm trying to remember now. It's been a while. There's a slight distinction. One of them has to do. I'm trying to figure out which one is which now. It seems like one of them had to do more with knowing a person, and the other one knowing facts and information and so forth. The kind of the perception there, and. Gnosko may be more of knowing the person, that type of thing, and oida the other, but I'd double check on that. It's kind of a matter of word study and refinement. I don't think it's quite as blatant as that, but that seems to be along the lines of what it was. It's been a while. I don't recall right offhand the detail of it, but both of them are quite frequently used. And of course, gnosis comes from that, and that in itself seems to be a little bit more broad than just the idea of knowing persons. So somebody may want to do a word study and contrast on those. Seems like there was another verb involved too, but I can't remember what it is now. There are some verbs that talk about, you know, just the mind and that type of thing, oriented toward more the actual mental process, but I'm not sure exactly which, you know, the nuances between those. And I suppose the probably only way to do it, some of the books may give a little bit of comment here and there. Most of them are just going to say to know for both of them. But if you check the lexicons and so forth, you probably get a little bit more refinement on it. And ultimately, what you'd probably have to do is just look them both up, see how they're used, and then set up a distinction yourself in the way they're actually used in the New Testament. Okay? Yes. Tony.
I just wonder, after listening to all the stuff we've talked about, it's like there's a lot of blurring, grammar, prepositions.
Yeah, that's the general philosophy.
Are there any grammar books that have been written that follow the same philosophy?
Well,
Are they all just this way?
Well, let me put it this way. I think Danan Manti is one of the best because he's not quite to the position we're at, I don't think. But as we go through it, you'll see what I mean. They're a lot more careful about root meanings, trying to see the essential idea rather than in getting down to the function of the words. So I think that's one of the best to me that comes to my mind. Robertson and his big detailed fat grammar, you know, the big thick one, you tend to find more refinement there. And although, you know, he's going to make some decisions, you know, that we probably wouldn't agree with too. But that the philosophy seems to be a little bit more. Part of it too, it's hard to know whether they're just trying to make it easy for the student, you know, just kind of gloss it so that they're not confusing the student, or whether it's just their philosophy. There's enough in here to indicate that the philosophy is bad, you know, in some of those areas. And it's what they've been trained in, you know. And I have talked to enough people who've taken Greek at other seminaries and that type of thing to see that same kind of thing reflected. They just are not really being trained to really look for that kind of refinement. If they can kind of get a rough and ready translation of it, that seems to be enough. And so.
Do you think it will cause a problem at all in the future as far as doing exegesis and teaching publicly, whether or not we can accept
it or not? Oh, it probably will. I'm sure it will. And it's hard to know what to do about that, except say, Lord, thou knowest, you know. I mean, in other words, if we come out and say the aorist participle is always referring to action, and the main verb, and Robertson or somebody else says sometimes it's simultaneous, they're going to say, well, who are you? Robertson says this, and who are you, you know? And I really don't know, you know, we're just going to have to say, stand the ground, as it were, and say that that the conclusions that he made on that are based on unbiased. Now, he himself states it's almost always the case with a few exceptions here. And then looking at those exceptions, we can always see a sense in which that's true, you know? In other words, we're going to have to be bucking the tide, as it were, a little bit. But see, most of these guys, that's what they did. I mean, how did they get in positions like that? They made some conclusions and so forth themselves. And usually, of course, if you've got a traditional denomination behind you or something like that, you're going to get more acceptance. But we just have to say, Lord, thou knowest, you know, and cut it straight. Be honest ourselves. The first thing is to be honest yourself, honest with your heart, honest with the Word of God. And if you come to a conclusion that's different than somebody else came to and they've got a bigger name than you do, well, if people are going to judge that way, they're going to be judging after the flesh. We have to judge after the Spirit and after the Lord. He's number one. And if people can't receive it, they can't receive it. We may want to do as much as we can to make it as easy as possible for them to receive it. We may want to debate the point and so forth and maybe point up some other scholars. Most of these issues, you'll probably find some scholars that dissent anyway, find some difference of opinion. If you can do that, you can say, well, see, the matter isn't that clear cut. There are scholars that... on both sides and so forth, and you could say that you're a scholar too, you know, but they'd probably say, well, you don't have a degree from Fuller or someplace like that, you just, you know, Community Chapel Bible College, what's that? But I have a feeling that after a while, after we've been in some debates and things, after we've, you know, knocked heads a little bit, there's going to be a certain respect that's gained by people, even if they don't agree. I had a little run-in with this fellow who's, I think it was at Fuller, he got in his Greek and so forth, and there were lots of points. In fact, he got a bit offended at me because I wasn't trying to be offensive, but I was just bringing out the point. He was arguing about John 1:1 and the position there and so forth. And then the position of the word logos relative to the word God and the articles and so forth. And so I just started rattling off things that we're all familiar with in this class. As far as how to determine the five reasons for ways to determine which is the predicate nominative and which is the subject and so forth. And he got offended at it, he said, "You're trying to patronize me," and so forth, as if I was talking down to him. I was just talking the facts. But it was pretty obvious that he hadn't been trained to that level, because it was like it was all new to him, or he'd forgotten it, and it really hadn't been involved in it. And one thing was certain, after that was all over, he didn't think that, because I didn't get my degree from Fuller, that I didn't know anything about it, And so that's something we have to, keep in mind, too, is that what you know and what you become, they can't take away from you. And what degrees and names and associations you have, of course, if men are going to judge after the flesh, that's the way they're going to judge. Some people you may never get any further with. But the history of progress in theology or any other area has been full of people who haven't had the degrees and the names, and they're usually ones that have pioneered new areas. I mean, who were Orville and Wilbur Wright, bicycle mechanics, and people like that. And they didn't have any credentials, and yet they established a whole new field. And now we look back at them and say how great they were. At the time, it wasn't being said how great they were. So you can ask Langley and some of those other guys how great they thought they were.
Right.
Yes.
Is there a help to use a Greek grammar written by a brain key that didn't claim to be a Christian, but just a secular Greek grammar?
Well, it may or it may not. It may help if you're looking for honesty sometimes. And I say that, carefully here, but there are times when a heathen doesn't have any axe to grind theologically.
Right.
Even a liberal, he doesn't believe any of it anyway. So, he doesn't care whether you have to have logos be a pre-existing Christ or not. And he may just say some things and bring out some data and so forth that is a little less biased. Sometimes Justinius is valuable in that respect. He's liberal. But sometimes he'll just cut it, straight. He doesn't have anything. He doesn't care, one way or the other, which way it comes out. But somebody else may care, and they may have a certain theological. In their mind, they're not trying to be dishonest, really, but that's the way that they're seeing it, and so it comes out that way. And so that will happen. But you have to be careful, because sometimes the heathen will have a bias against the supernatural. And so if you're dealing with something supernatural, they may give you a biased view on that and analyze a word that's not properly analyzed because of the bias there. But they may not have a bias as to whether oneness or Trinity is correct. Or they may not have a bias about the baptism of the Holy Ghost or anything like that, you see. Because those are real relevant issues to them. The main issue is whether the Bible is inspired or not. So you have to kind of know what their viewpoint is and be able to use them. But, of course, you have to be careful, too, to who you're talking to and who will receive that. If they are a Christian, a spirit-filled, and you're talking about the Trinity and oneness controversy and so forth, they may say, well, that guy is a liberal, and so I won't take anything he has to say. And if they're in that position, you may not get anywhere with it. As far as your own exegesis and coming to understanding of truth, then you may be able to use a lot of different sources. You can see there's a difference here. Unfortunately, there's a difference between your own personal studies and coming to truth and what you can bring to somebody else and they'll be able to receive. I wish it weren't the case, but unfortunately it is. And the state of the theological world is such that we're really having a difficulty now even getting to communication. If you can get to the point where you both agree the Bible's inspired word of God, you've gotten a long ways nowadays. And to the degree to which it's inspired. Even an evangelical may believe it's inspired. He may even say it's inspired from cover to cover, but when it comes down to certain issues, like the ones that Don raised in some of his sermons, they may not. And may not feel the same way you do. So
I've seen Christians who, especially with Walton Martin, he was discussing something that got to the point. He talked about, he called up the Greek professor at UCLA, and he was a classical Greek. And Walter thought it was so great that this classical Greek professor agree with him. He thought that settled the whole matter.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't necessarily settle anything. You have to know what the bias is and so forth. I would say this. It's just like in a courtroom or something. When a lawyer brings in a witness that, because of his situation, would not be expected to have any bias in the matter, that witness's testimony has more credence than somebody you bring in that has got an obvious bias in the matter. And so It depends on what the matter is, what the issue is, and whether the witness, you know, may or may not have that. So in that case of Walter Martin's, I may or may not agree with him on that. It depends on what the issue was and what the bias may or may not be. If it was classical Greek and his oriented, I don't know what the issue was, but if it was dealing with a matter of the Godhead issue or something like that, in which the traditional, you know. Oh, was it? Okay.
He called him on that.
Oh.
He thought, most people would see this, but he's a Greek professor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. Well, it may be, but again, you know, I don't put. I would say, if, to strengthen the argument, I would say, not this fellow at UCLA. I mean, who knows who is who. But to take a consensus, maybe, of a number of the scholars on that, and say this is what the consensus is of many of these that don't have an axe to grind. They're just saying this is what it is. And that would have a lot more weight than just taking one here or one there and calling up one and so forth and getting an answer like that. Because you can call up people sometimes and they don't know what the issue is. You're just asking. This can happen, you know, I sometimes will not answer people because I don't know what they're getting at and what they want and, you know, what the background is and what they're going to do with the information, you know. They can take your statement out of context and give it a completely different sense than what you intended. So we have to be careful with that. And this whole thing of consulting authorities can be a problem if you don't do it properly. There's argumentum ad verecundium, where you consult an authority who's not an expert on that particular subject. In other words, he may be smart in this other area, so you use his smartness in that area to say that your theology is correct, you know, but that may not be the case. In this case, that probably wouldn't have been the case. You're looking for a scholar in this particular area, but I'd be skeptical of just taking one man's testimony over the phone, you know, making that the proof and the end all to the Jehovah's Witnesses. Yes? Sure. Right. Exactly. Sure. Yeah, a Jehovah's Witness might call him up and ask him, you know, from a different standpoint and ask it in a different way and get the answer he wants. You know. See, the bottom line is it all boils down to really being honest in your heart. You know, most people can in their own hearts at least, they kind of know when they're trying to twist a little bit, trying to put some pressure on something. They want it to be that way so bad, and they're going to try to find. They're going to find all the witnesses that will prophesy smooth things, tell them what they want to hear. And in your own heart before the Lord, this is not an easy thing to do always, but in your own heart before the Lord, we need to say, Lord, am I really being honest here? And consider all the possibilities and put them to the test and so forth, and come up with the best thing from your own heart and from an honesty standpoint. Get the best data that you can. Try to evaluate the data on the basis of what's likely to be biased and what's not. Not just taking everything superficially. Some people don't make any discriminations when they collect data either. They just throw all the clean and the unclean fish into the net, you know, and they make no distinction as to what is likely to be biased and so forth. And it admittedly takes some time to do that, but after a while, after you've been walking with the Lord for a while, you start to see those things come up, and you'll see them. You see them in commentaries all the time, and you've seen things in this book also, and you'll see them from here on out. And we need to know how to evaluate some of those things. And it's good training to get into situations that are difficult to try to have to evaluate and weigh things. It's not always so black and white, but if we use some discrimination, some judgment, and pray and seek the Lord and have a body. Now, one thing that thrills me is to have as many of you now getting trained in these areas, because now we're getting to a point where we want to deal with an issue. We can put several people on the same thing and have them search it out and then compare the conclusions that they come up with. And I think that's going to be a real strength. It's going to be a real strength of this assembly. It's going to help prevent error, because a person may make a mistake in a certain area, another brother may catch him on it, you know. I've got some mistakes in the book here, and you guys have been catching it, you know, and I appreciate that. I think we've got a good, you know, this is one of the best classes we've had that way, and I want to keep encouraging that. I want to strive for excellence in every area. And so it's worthwhile to take some time once in a while to talk about these things to get the perspective. Because this is the kind of thing you probably wouldn't get in a lot of Greek classes. They'll just give you what the book says and do the exercise and that's it. And people, and I can tell because people come out with that kind of attitude. Well, that's, it's all settled. It's all black and white. That's what the textbook said. And if they got another textbook and they saw that, they said, well, wait a minute here. You know, what's going on? You know, it's black and white as long as you've only got one textbook to go from. It's like that, you know, the man who's got one watch always knows what time it is. The man with two watches is never sure, you know. And it's that's something to keep in mind. So I would encourage you, you know, for the purposes of teaching a class like this, it's not really wise to bring in a lot of textbooks and be going part through this one, part through that one. You get confused. When I first took Greek, we used Machen a bit and did some exercises on that. And it was okay. The book's good, but it's set up completely different than Getch's. And so if you try to follow with two books at once, you can get muddled up in the middle. I found it's better just to take one of them, go through that, and then use the others to supplement when you're all done. Now, so that's what I'm saying is, after you've gone through it in Getch's, you might grab Machen or grab one of the other, if you've got another Greek grammar or something, and scan through it, and you'll be able to recognize things now. You know what, and you'll see the different structure and how it's set up. And sometimes some of the books may present something a little bit different angle that is just what you needed, and it clarified a point that maybe was confusing here. And so I want to encourage you to supplement that if you can. And Dane and Manti is one real good one for supplement, and he's set up. Dane and Manti would not be a good book to use for first year Greek to teach Greek. It's just not set up that way. He's not set up to go through in systematic way all the things, but he goes through and gives you more detailed information on different facets, and things like the tense ideas, the case functions, the prepositional root meanings, things like that that are really valuable. So it's a good book to have after you've got this one, get Dane and Manti, and then maybe look at a few others, and then your lexicons and your text and so forth, and you should be in pretty good shape. And of course, don't forget the analytical lexicon. You still need that no matter how much of this you go through once in a while. But usually, usually use that when you find your regular verbs. The regular ones you'll probably be able to recognize real easily. Even up to this point, you'd be surprised, even with these perfect and blue perfect forms. They're not bad as far as recognition is concerned. But once you get these real bad irregular ones, then you may want to pull that thing out. It's a lot worse than Hebrew, though, because the vocabulary. You see, in Greek, you only got 5,000 words or so for your total vocabulary in the New Testament. And the Hebrew Old Testament, I don't know what the number is, but I'm sure it's more than that. And you've got other complications in Hebrew, as the Hebrew students can well attest. So I don't think you'll ever get to the point in Hebrew where you don't need the lexicon unless you just start. And you cut English out of your life and speak Hebrew the rest of your life or something, and speak it exclusively. Okay, and even then, modern Hebrew wouldn't necessarily prepare you to deal with all the vocabulary in the Old Testament. All right, any other questions or comments on that area? I think it's worth looking at a little bit and stopping to consider some of the things the place where we're at as far as this Greek is concerned. We don't want to know just enough Greek to be dangerous, you know, we want to have some judgments and some basis for it, be willing to be looking things and not just look up something in a lexicon or a book someplace and have that be the end of the matter. I never like to finish any word study, for example, by just looking at the lexicons. I don't consider looking at the lexicon doing a word study, at least a thorough job. Not that they're going to be way off the mark. They're probably going to be pretty close. And if it's quick, and all you want to do is get the essential idea, that's fine. But if you really want something that's dealing with something that's crucial theologically, not only look up the word in the lexicons, but look up, get your concordance out and find out every place where that word is used in the New Testament and evaluate each of those passages and try to get a consensus there within the text to see how it's being used. And that's a more reliable index. Okay, section 374, summary of principal parts. But since we have now completed the study of the principal parts of Greek verbs, it is convenient to conclude this lesson with a short table indicating the manner of forming the principal parts of regular verbs, that is, verbs which end as indicated in the left-hand column below, in the first person singular, present indicative, active indicative. Okay, what this is doing then is summarizing all six principal parts for regular verbs. This only applies to regular ones now. And so we have several categories here. We have the contract verbs, which are reasonably regular. So we have a-o, and then another a-o type that some types get alphas and sometimes get etas. And there's a footnote about that. The ones that have the stem ending in a vowel or a ro will get alpha through the paradigm. As far as these perfects, you see, if you look at The first column of the a-o verbs is aso, asa, aka, amai, athen. The second row there is aso, asa, aka, amai, athen. So it's just alphas all the way through instead of atas. And that occurs when the base ends in a vowel or a row. And you'll find that out in this exercise. Then the e-o verbs, the o-o, that completes your contract verbs. Then idzo, adzo, and uo, those are among the regular ones. And although the idzo sometimes have a future and just an omega ending there, contract futures they call them. Okay, so that's kind of a good summary as to the kinds of verbs that are there. Now, this doesn't include all verbs by any means, and of course, there are lots of irregular ones. But this will help you with some of the most regular ones and to get familiar with the basic pattern that's going to be followed. And of course, you need that for this exercise. Okay, let's look at exercise 47A then. And this first section, I think I'll just go through myself, get the forms. Number one here, what you're supposed to do is give the perfect active and the perfect middle and passive form. You could have cheated and just looked these up in the lexicon and seen the forms. But hopefully these are all verbs that fit into the categories of this chart that we just looked at. And then, of course, to get the reduplication, you have to go back to the previous, those five categories of how to make the reduplication. So if you add that information to this information, you can figure out the forms. So kopia'o would be the perfect active, should be kekopiaka. That's kappa epsilon kappa omicron p iota alpha kappa alpha. It's an alpha type because it's an a'o verb that ends in the stem ends in the iota there. It's a vowel. So it's going to get the alpha types through the paradigm. And the perfect middle and passive would be kekopiamai. That's again kappa epsilon kappa omicron p iota alpha mu alpha iota. Same thing there, alpha because of the stem ending in the vowel. Questions?
Optional epsilon.
Yes, right. That's only for the pluperfect. Excuse me, that's only for the pluperfect. This is perfect middle passive. Yeah, that's a good point. I'm glad you brought it up though, because it's remember that the optional augment is for pluperfect only. And remember, your pluperfect form is not one of the principal parts. The principal parts are only perfect and perfect middle and passive. The pluperfect are built on those, so you don't need to have that as a principal part. Okay, number two, apatao, to deceive. The perfect active should be apateka, that's eta, p alpha, tau, eta, kappa alpha. Eta because the thing begins in a vowel. And when it begins with a vowel, the reduplication is the same as the augment would be. So you go back to your augment rules, as it were, for vowels, and alphas go to atas. So it's apatika. Okay, then your perfect middle passive would be apatemai. That's eta, p, alpha, tau, eta, mu, alpha, iota. Questions? Anybody there? Okay, number three. Foreo, to where? We have pephoreka. Pephoreka, P, epsilon, phi, omicron, rho, eta, kappa, alpha. Okay, your reduplication is going to be peh because the C is going to get hardened there. And your ending, it's an eo verb, so the eo is, according to this chart over here, will get an eta, kappa, alpha. And then pephoremai, P, epsilon, phi, omicron, rho, eta, mu, alpha, iota for the perfect middle passage. Number four. Skopeo, to notice. The perfect active would be eskopeka, epsilon, sigma, kappa, omicron, p, eta, kappa, alpha. Now remember, this is one that has sigma, kappa, two consonants together. And unless one of those consonants, the second one's a lambda or a rho, the rule is that they just get epsilon for the reduplication. So that was, I can't remember which one of the five it was, but about the third one or so. Let's see. It's good to point these things out just so you can get them solidified. But it's the second one there on page 288. It's a verb base number two. There begins with C, zeta, or C, or with two consonants other than a consonant plus lambda or rho. The reduplicating syllable simply epsilon. So that's the rule that covers that. apparently it just gets too awkward to say something like stethoscopica, you know, to put two consonants in a row twice. Yes? Question?
On page
332,
they do have one that has a
syllable. 332? Oh, in the chart in the back, you mean?
Yeah, they do have one that has a syllable
space.
And the
syllable
passes.
So, yeah, but that's just a sigma. See, what we're talking about is when you get two consonants in a row, if it was sigma copper or something like that. See, it's not an issue of just sigma, it's two consonants in a row. In this case, our verb over here is scopeo, it's sigma kappa, two consonants together. That's the issue.
The one above it is strepho.
Yeah, strepho, now that's got the roll. I mean, it's tau. Oh, excuse me. Yeah, it's tau, so it would be in the same category. And so it's estreps there for the aorist. And estromi, there's no perfect active, but estromi for the perfect middle passive. That would be in this category. If you had something that was just the second letter is a lambda or a rho, like trefo there on the chart. Trefo also, but trefo further down has got the full paradigm at least, and you can see it's tetropha. You do get the reduplication with the tau, in spite of the fact that there's two in a row. So if it's a rho or a lambda, apparently those will work. You can go ahead and.
Yeah, the perfect middle passive goes to a theta on a tetromi.
Yes, okay. Yeah, and that one you probably wouldn't be able to predict. But you still got the rho there.
Yeah.
But they softened the theta.
The second consonant has to be a lambda rho. Because it's like the example.
Yes, the second. Right.
Consonant.
Yeah, that's the reason that one doesn't work. It has to be the second consonant, the second one that's a lambda or rho. Of course, if you get three of them, you're probably going to be in trouble no matter how you look at it. And I was trying to find one with the lambda. Do we have any with the lambda in the second position here in the chart? There's one with a double lambda. That wouldn't really be what we're looking for. Yeah, play role.
That's a regular one. It's
on the chart. Okay. But play role would be in this category.
Oh, wait. Pep Leroux.
On page 288,
that Leroux is Pep
Leroux. Yeah, Pep Leroux. Yeah, I thought I'd seen it someplace. I guess it was back in the text here. Back in the 288? Right. Okay. Yeah, the bottom one is in that category. Good. So, again, you get the reduplication there. Okay. That bell ring already? No, we've got a couple more minutes. Number five, then, thalmazo to marvel, the tethalmaka, that's tau, epsilon, theta, alpha, upsilon, mu, alpha, kappa, alpha. And that's just coming from the chart here. That's the only way I figured that out. It's akka there, you get alpha, kappa, alpha. And then tethalmasmai. Tau, epsilon, theta, alpha, upsilon, mu, alpha, sigma, mu, alpha, iota. And that's just your osmi from this chart. Yeah?
Did you give us the middle and passive for tau?
Oh, maybe I didn't. Okay. That should be escopemai. Epsilon, sigma, kappa, omicron, p, eta, mu, alpha, iota. Okay. Okay, any questions on number five here now?
Well, yeah, you repeat the perfect middle.
Okay, it should be tethalmasmai. Tethalmasmai should be tau, epsilon, theta, alpha, upsilon, mu, alpha, sigma, mu, alpha, iota. Tethalmasmai, I guess, would be the accent. No, I guess it'd be tethalmasmai. Could go ahead and put it on that. Okay, play row O. Oh, no. Poro O. There's a lot of O's there. To harden, peporoka, P, epsilon, P, omicron, rho, omega, kappa, alpha. So omega here because the O verbs are going to take that form.
Is there an omicron in there?
It's an omicron in the first one. Let's see. No, wait a minute here. No, there's. It should be omegas in both places, yeah, because the first one was part of the stem. Yeah, okay, I'm going to change that. Yeah. See, that first one shouldn't change. Okay, so there's it's P epsilon P omega rho omega kappa alpha. The first omega is part of the stem. The second one is because of the contract verb. And then peporomai, P epsilon P omega rho omega mu alpha iota. Okay. Well, we'll stop there. And as I said, we'll go through this one in part B here, which is real easy. It's a pretty easy exercise, but its main purpose is to show you how close some of these forms can be, you know. And then 47E, so we'll finish that up tomorrow, or Tuesday again. Then we've got three chapters left. Reflects the reciprocal pronouns. These are kind of odds and ends, at least in the next chapter. And then we'll look at the vocatives and uses of the cases, a little bit more refinement on the cases. The last chapter is just the optative mood. So. Okay. No, I don't think I have. I've heard of it, but I haven't had a chance to really go through it. Have you looked at it enough to find it?
I looked at it just a little bit. Yeah, no. That thing, though, had a very long article on not that was maybe interesting. On Eric being spontaneous action.
Oh, yes. On the participle? Yeah. Okay. Does he agree with it or disagree with it?
Yeah, he's the same. He's just kind of the same extent.
Oh, okay. Just, okay. Yeah, I'd be interested to look at that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of like to look at that, but maybe if I've got time this afternoon. Is this from the college library to grad library? It's grad library, okay. Yeah.
I heard it referred to, but that's a real
I haven't read him enough to see what his viewpoint is on those. Have you looked at some of his other examples and so forth too to see if he's?
Yeah, he seems to be. he looked good. I looked on the perfect, and he made some points that were true, but he seemed like he had kind of easy to change around the maybe the root meaning of it to fit according to context.
Okay, I'll take a look at that.